So good evening and welcome to the annual Raymond Williams Society lecture, which this year is co-sponsored by the Centre for Interdisciplinary Research in Arts and Languages, or CIDRAL, at the University of Manchester. My name is David Alderson, and by pure coincidence I sit on the Executive Committee of the Raymond Williams Society and am Director of CIDRAL. It's funny how these freakish coincidences. The Raymond Williams Society exists to promote the legacy of critic and cultural theorists after whom it is named, and to promote... is it still working?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to promote the theoretical tradition of cultural materialism that he inaugurated. It does so through events such as this, and through its annual publication of the journal Key Words, the latest issue of which focuses on aspects of the multidimensional crisis through which we are living. We shall be launching it officially with its editors Robert Spencer and Chris Bardi during a wine reception at the end of this lecture. The Raymond Williams Society is a registered charity run on an entirely voluntary basis and with the usual precarious finances that characterise such institutions. If you enjoy this lecture and support the aims of the Society, your support and membership would be very much welcome. You can find membership forms at the back of the hall, I hope. And you can certainly buy copies of the journal. Tonight's speaker is David Wilkinson, and it's a great pleasure to introduce him as one of the most astute and interesting among a generation of scholars and activists who have taken up and developed cultural materialism. David is a lecturer at Manchester Metropolitan University, where in fact he studied for his undergraduate degree before living in Berlin, travelling to the United States, and returning to England to study his master's and doctoral degrees at the University of Manchester. His work focuses on, for want of a better term, popular music, subculture and countercultures. And he is the author of a brilliant study of post-punk titled Post-Punk, Politics and Pleasure, published by Palgrave in 2016. As the title suggests, its innovative and important contribution is to refuse to take the category of pleasure as a given, but rather subject it to serious, if never puritanical, scrutiny in a way that resonates with Williams's own treatment of feeling. For David, as for Herbert Marcuse, on whom he draws, understanding the actual or potential political valences of pleasure is an important project, and is clearly related to his strong interest in utopian thought and possibilities. It is this strand of his work that he'll be talking about today in a lecture titled The Dropouts Are Anticipating Future Economic Policy, Work, Class and Countercultural Legacies. David.
Thank you very much, David. Yes, the title of my talk today is The Dropouts Are Anticipating Future Economic Policy. And that's a quote that comes from Richard Neville. It was written in 1970. It's in his countercultural classic, Play Power. In a passage reminiscent of contemporary debates over the impact of new technologies and automation, Richard Neville views the potential consequences of these technologies with an optimism typical of the post-war years, an optimism that we sadly lost for some decades, but may now be rediscovering. We'd better learn to how to use the leisure bonus, Neville writes, advocating the hippie revival of play as the best revolution around under circumstances under which it was expected that automation would generally reduce working hours. That hasn't happened, as I'm sure we all know. In the wake of socialist resurgence across the UK, Europe and the States, such countercultural hedonism has often coloured the left's rediscovery of a technologically grounded anti-work ethic. Its pranksterous provocation underpins Navarra media linchpin Aaron Bastani's fully automated luxury communism, not to mention the online meme culture from which that book's title originated. Even, I would say, the use of the word communist these days can be incendiary in a countercultural sense, given the intervening decades since the advent of neoliberalism and Margaret Thatcher's dictum, there is no alternative. Aaron Bastani's comrades from Navarra Media, Ash Sarkar, demonstrated this when she engaged in a vintage classic of youth cultural media baiting, retorting to Piers Morgan's repeated travestying of her political position on his TV programme with, "I'm literally a communist, you idiots." Meanwhile, almost everything about the Laburia Kibonic Collective's The Xenofeminist Manifesto, its desire to abolish the nuclear family and to technologically minimise reproductive labour, its lurid science fictional cut-and-paste aesthetic, all of this echoes an era of women's liberation struggles bound up with the utopian promise of the underground. Nor is this impulse confined to those with no biographical connection to the 60s and 70s, more easily able to romanticise an era they never knew. We were just talking earlier in the meeting for the Raymond Williams Society Journal, Keywords, about the lost generation, basically, on the left, how you've got a generation which, I guess, people like Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell, Diane Abbott, and so on, belong to, along with many, many others. And then you've got a generation, perhaps just about including me, but largely younger than me, actually. And in the middle, you've kind of got this lost generation who were Thatcher and Blair's children. And it's interesting amongst that generation that some of them are just about old enough for their childhoods to have this kind of hauntological resonance when it comes to the counterculture. They're not quite old enough to have participated in it directly, but they're old enough to have lived in its aftermath, in its wake, and all the things that it birthed. And certainly their childhoods took place when the original 60s and 70s moment of the counterculture was in full flow. So they have that kind of hazy and yet extremely affectively powerful recollection of it, I would argue. One of these people, I would say, is Paul Mason. So both his post-capitalism and his clear, bright future, a radical defence of the human being, sort of shot through with that messianic urgency of the countercultural missives in their calls for an ecologically sustainable, automation-led post-scarcity economy. Not to mention occasionally a transgressive penchant for profanity in the service of liberation. He seems to love the word bullshit, for instance, in Clear Bright Future. Perhaps most explicitly of that generation, the late Mark Fisher had begun work on a project entitled Acid Communism shortly before his passing in 2017. Typically for Fisher, that unfinished introduction to what was always meant to be a larger project seems haunted by the ghosts of historical possibilities. Nevertheless, for a thinker who is normally associated with developing the notion of capitalist realism, he offers quite an uncharacteristically sunny assessment of the potential of the 60s and 70s counterculture. He demands that we revisit its stumbling beginning to what he calls a life freed from drudgery. Recently, the cultural theorist Jeremy Gilbert has developed a somewhat more reformist and yet recognisable continuation of Fisher's project in the form of acid Corbynism rather than acid communism. All of this, I would say, is promising and worthwhile. Obviously, politically, that's the case. But intellectually, it's the case too. And that's because it updates a dominant position on the intellectual left, one that's prevailed for at least a few decades now. I associate that position with thinkers like Slavoj Žižek, and it's the insistence that the kind of libertarian utopian energies of the counterculture have both fed and been absorbed by the neoliberal reorganisation of production and consumption. So there's very little to be gained from revisiting that 60s and 70s legacy, because not only has it been recuperated by capitalism, for these thinkers, it was actually a precursor of neoliberal capitalism itself. This isn't a position that's limited to scholarly circles either. So A couple of months ago, the parodic adult comic Viz featured far out frolics with Sir Richard Branson. I'll just talk you through the plot briefly, and you can get a sense of what I kind of consider to be a dominant structure of feeling when it comes to the way people think about the counterculture nowadays. So in this cartoon, the long-haired founder of the global Virgin business empire tires of lounging on his private island, listening to Hare and Hendrix. Surrounded by sacks of cash, priceless art treasures and the like, he recalls the anti-materialistic rhetoric of the counterculture and vows to live a simpler life. Enlisting his butler to carry Branson's painted VW camper van across the Atlantic all the way to England, said armchair style, he sets up a teepee in the grounds of a hospital for sick orphans. After getting hassled by the pigs for his encroachment on private property, Branson orders Virgin Demolitions to knock down the orphanage. But this still does not satisfy him. Unhappy with the eyeballing he receives from uptight squares during his naked meditation session, Branson's solution is to order his private army to annihilate the surrounding city, leaving him happily back where he started on a tiny remaining patch of land, as Big Ben and the remaining hapless citizenry sink into the rising ocean around him. So, though undoubtedly amusing, I would argue that such a position is starting to feel a little bit dated, right? In a world of increasing crises and political contestation, in which I would say we've more or less definitively moved on from that 1989 to 2008 end of history era, perhaps it's time to look back on the counterculture in less cynical and jaded terms. Nevertheless, I've got a caveat to offer, and that's that Richard Neville's analysis does haunt the present in ways that complicate socialist claims on countercultural inheritance. At times, Play Power, written all the way back in 1970, sounds less like a utopian manifesto and more like a giddy anticipation of the vast expansion of the cultural industries in the neoliberal era. Neville writes, "Non-workers include artists, craftsmen and media men. Today, media is substitute play. That is why the underground is obsessed with media." As in neoliberal ideology, in Neville's vision, culture is both aesthetic pleasure and economic panacea, goes hand in hand with a contempt for the supposed philistinism, puritanism and backwardness of the working class. In his view, proletarians become scapegoats for conservative ills in pretty disturbing ways that to me echo kind of current cultural divisions over Brexit. The way that to be a remainer or a leaver has almost become a new form of cultural identity. So Neville calls working class people in Play Power authoritarian xenophobic hardhats who fear black men's cocks. Right. So there's a theme developing there, and that theme is around class. As early as 1975, the Birmingham Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies saw the counterculture as a profoundly adaptive middle class response to post-war shifts in the capitalist productive base. As spheres like media and consumption expanded, the system required not just a more flexible, hedonistic consciousness. It also needed those with the skills to produce and promote that consciousness. According to the CCCS, middle-class countercultural youth were thus the vanguard of this consciousness production amongst their wider class fraction. They shook off fashion, education, sexual mores, working patterns and more. And in doing so, they faced a predictable backlash from their more straight-laced forebears, like the Moral Campaign and Mary Whitehouse. The CCCS did acknowledge the contested nature of countercultural revolt. They weren't entirely pessimistic. They noted that a deeper disaffiliation from the dominant was possible, and they hinted at the counterculture's utopian dimensions. As they noted, once you take the lid off, once you start questioning the conventions of society, in more or less every sphere, as the counterculture did, whether it be domestic relations, whether it be romantic relations, the question of labour and so on, the question of the environment, it can be hard to put that lid back on. Nevertheless, they remained ambiguous about the politics of what they called in 1975 an unfinished cultural trajectory. What I want to do with this project, effectively, is to return to that unfinished trajectory. I want to explore whether the legacy of the counterculture may still play a role in contemporary left imaginaries of a post-work society, or if it's more likely to animate destructive hostilities between class fractions that otherwise would be united in the present by their precarious and exploited status. So, as I've flagged up, that question of class and class fractions is key to my argument, especially the way that they interact. And the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies analysis, right, that the counterculture was an avant-garde outgrowth of the middle class that has now transformed the middle class as a whole, is partly persuasive. But it does suffer from a limitation that's been identified time and time again in scholarship on subcultures and countercultures. And that criticism of the CCCS is this. Is it really so simple as locating various countercultures and subcultures within a singular class basis? So their argument, right, is a form of structuralist Marxism that says counterculture equals dissident middle class, and subcultures like skinheads, mods, etc. Are instances of dissident working class subculture. What they don't do is discuss the possibility that subcultures and countercultures might consist of members from differing class backgrounds. Well, that's resulted, unfortunately, in decades of postmodern scholarly drift, is a sense that ultimately class doesn't matter anymore when we're talking about subculture and counterculture. Especially that shift to kind of studies of consumption in the field. You see people making really bizarre, contorted arguments that say, oh, we can account for people's belongings to various subcultures or groups or whatever on the basis of their aesthetic taste. And you're like, how does that make sense? Isn't that the same thing, right? That their aesthetic taste sort of signifies belonging to a group. It's not the explanation for their belonging to a group. So, you know, in the supposed post-subcultural turn, you get people arguing that we can safely forget class and consign it to the dustbin of history when we're thinking about the question of counterculture and subcultural belonging. I want to posit a different way of thinking about this that is still maintains the class basis of the CCCS analysis, but is a little bit more nuanced. And in doing so, I've found that Raymond Williams's work on cultural formations is an especially helpful way to think about this problem. What Williams argues about cultural formation, which, if you're not familiar with the term, is basically collective groups of cultural producers that have got some sort of shared aim in common and often certain institutions in common. What he says about those cultural formations is that they don't just arise within one particular class, such as the working class, the ruling class, the middle class, or whatever. He says, additionally, there's a basis for those cultural formations coming together in the changing relations between a particular class and other classes. What if we understood the counterculture in this way? After all, the post-war working class not only faced transformations of its own as automation, amongst other factors, reshaped its patterns of labour and culture. The working class was also, in this post-war period, far from unaffected by concurrent changes within the middle class. And in part this was because of the social mobility opened up by the post-war consensus. It meant a significant fraction of working class youth experienced an uneven and often uneasy amalgamation of middle class culture, education and employment and expectations with their proletarian roots. So you get these sort of strange So you get these people who are in between, basically, and this still happens to this day. If you look at Jackson and Marsden's seminal study of the effects of the 1944 Education Act, Education in the Working Class, where they go out and interview a load of working class grammar school students, you see this sort of sense of outsiderdom and in-betweenness all over the place. One of the people they interviewed for that book said, "I had this feeling of not belonging anywhere," right? So they'd come from one sort of cultural background of the working class. They'd been educated out of that, if you like, according to middle-class conventions. A lot of them then got middle-class jobs. And if you're not born, as I'm sure many of us in this room know, if you're not born to a class culture, then even when you join it, you can feel kind of uneasy and uncertain, perhaps for the rest of your life, effectively. But there's no going back either. So given this, it's not hard to understand why many from this class fraction might be drawn to the romantic bohemianism of the counterculture and its immediate precursors. Discussing the dislocation experienced by working class grammar school students, Jackson and Marsden interestingly claimed that the beginnings at school could seem almost hallucinatory. How about that? If, as Mark Fisher argues, the question of consciousness is the defining feature of psychedelia, then it becomes even clearer why it might be that some from this working class fraction ended up joining the countercultural underground. Their disorientating social experience resonated directly with the counterculture's explorations of altered states. So this line that I'm pursuing, basically, that the counterculture consisted both of the dissident middle class and the socially mobile but dislocated working class meeting in the middle, has important political ramifications, and formal ones as well at a cultural level, as we'll see. And I'm at an early stage in this project still, but what I've discovered so far is that the more middle class manifestations of countercultural production unfortunately sometimes confirm that more pessimistic analysis of the CCCS. For all their seeming radicalism, there may largely have been signs of a class reforming itself to cope with a developing mode of capitalist production. And what's interesting about that is that they often do so in ways that are not just emergent, they're not just a kind of avant-garde of their class, the counterculture. They often have kind of deep residual roots in older forms of middle-class culture in the way that they go about things. I should stress, though, that I'm not taking a kind of partisan, class-based identity politics attitude to this, where middle-class equals automatically bad and working-class equals automatically good. It's been noted by thinkers on the left, like Perry Anderson and Alan Sinfield, that the dissident middle class has played a significant historical part in the development of British socialism. So I am hoping eventually to find some more middle class manifestations of counterculture that point towards more radical ends. That said, the two pieces of cultural production that I want to discuss later by those with working class roots do seem a bit more self-conscious about the potentials and the pitfalls involved in visions of technology, automation, and non-alienated labour. That's Ray Gosling, the broadcast of Ray Gosling's memoir Sum Total, and the 1968 film Charlie Bubbles. And what I would argue is it's precisely their class, their awkward class position, right, their socially mobile working class position, that affords them their self-consciousness about the difficulties of trying to imagine a post-work society. Okay, so I want to move on to my first example of middle-class countercultural dissidents. And this is related to some archival research that I've been doing this year on the British Underground countercultural press. If you look at the scholarship on this, there's very little out there on the British Underground press. It's either on the US Underground press, or it's on the very canonical British hippie magazines like International Times or Oz or whatever. when you look into those archives, what you discover is that there was a scene of underground publishing associated with the counterculture that was almost as diverse and explosive as the later explosion of punk fanzines. And so far it's proven to be a really, really rich kind of research source for the project. So that's where some of this research comes from. And the first instance of middle-class dissidents that I'm going to look at comes from the magazine Ether. And I mentioned before how the counterculture in its middle-class form wasn't just an emergent avant-garde development. It had those residual middle-class cultural elements within it too. And this is another point at which the work of Raymond Williams becomes relevant. So, in Culture and Society, Williams notes that at least since the 19th century, the education system in Britain has trained a middle-class fraction to professional labour that is rooted in a slightly different ethic to the usual one of possessive individualism that we might associate with the middle class. He says, what that education that trains people into the professions does is gives people an idea of service to society, right? And because of that, Williams, as a socialist, accords it some respect. You know, it's not as individualistic, it's not as selfish a motivation as lies at the root of a lot of middle class culture. It's got an outward looking sense. It imagines that the work you do is for the benefit of others, and indeed for society as a whole, if you're a professional rather than a business person. So Williams accords that ethic that develops in the 19th century some respect. But what he notes about it is this: because it arises within the middle class, it's got certain limitations. So for instance, it nearly always tilts back to reformism within an existing system politically. It rarely takes the kind of revolutionary leap. Worryingly too, it tends to fail to be able to ascribe culture, agency or leadership to a working class whose lives it has at times deigned to improve. More recently, Mike Wayne has done important work on the growth of this ethic, its connections with economic change and its political expressions. Wayne observes that liberalism's core dictum is captured by Thomas Macaulay's statement, "Reform that you may preserve." If we discount what Williams identifies as the conformist and self-denying elements of this service ethic, and we discount those because in the post-war period, right, is very different to the late 19th century. At this point, that kind of deference and very obviously symbolically ingrained class system in Britain is being undermined. So you still have a class system in the post-war period, but that sense that people keep to their separate spheres is breaking down. You also have kind of consumerist appeals to individual desire. So the service ethic continues within the middle class, but it becomes slightly less ascetic, it becomes slightly less self-denying. And we find it, that service ethic, in countercultural production. So this magazine, Ether, for instance, it seems on the face of it to be as radical as they come. It grows out of a commune on the edge of the Cairngorms in Scotland. It has links with Aberdeen University's Environmentalist Society, which in the early, you know, with the rise of Extinction Rebellion, with the question of climate change being a key issue faced by the two potential candidates for Prime Minister of this country yesterday on the first debate of this general election, we all tend to assume that the issue of the environment and climate change is a commonsensical one nowadays. But in the early 1970s, to be addressing this was quite forward-looking. The magazine was printed by the Aberdeen People's Press. Yes, such a thing existed. And it tended to focus on ecology, technology, and new forms of work and living. An article from 1974, beginning at the end, reviews the green thinker Keith Hudson's work. And what it notes is interesting in terms of automation, technology, work. It argues that capital investment in automation is going to produce what the writer called vertical slice on employment across classes and regions. So basically what's meant by that is that automation isn't just going to put working class people out of work, it's going to vertically slice across the class system as certain jobs are becoming automated. And we see echoes of this in the present, right? It's not just working class jobs that are vulnerable to automation, but professional jobs too. And they're like, what are we going to do about this? What's the kind of radical countercultural solution, if you like? So it being an environmentalist magazine, the first thing that they propose is economic degrowth. And they propose a return to communal living and effectively a kind of anarchistic political structure. So on the face of it, you couldn't get more kind of ultra-leftist and radical in terms of the approach that this magazine is taking. But one statement in particular stands out here, and that's this. The vertical slice style of unemployment will allow people of talent who until now have been creamed off into high-paid industry to return to the community where their skills will prove invaluable for the leadership of social change. So, despite the professed radicalism, there's still that assumption of middle-class leadership and a reformist emphasis on finding solutions, with little to no discussion of the inevitable kind of class conflict or political conflict that you would assume would accompany a transition from the kind of economy we live in to one of degrowth, communalism and anarchism, right? Looked at with hindsight, such talk of leadership of communities seems almost a premonition of gentrification, a key component of capital's shift into finance, real estate and the service industry, since automation and offshoring have restructured the British economy. As has been well documented in the field of critical urban studies, gentrification relies precisely on such middle-class people of talent, often from backgrounds in culture and media. And the pattern is this, we're all familiar with it, right? They take up pioneering residence amongst economically marginal and depressed urban communities. This is known in the business as cultural leverage. So these pioneers, right, these avant-garde pioneers, go and move somewhere rubbish. That results in regeneration in the form of inflated real estate markets and service sector investment. Now, I'm not suggesting that Aether was a kind of neat premonition of this, but you can certainly detect the beginnings of that process, if not in the direct arguments that they make, at least sometimes in the sort of unintentional style, the fact that they assume such things as middle-class leadership and so on. This strange, ambiguous perspective, this tension between radical, even revolutionary middle-class dissidents, on the one hand, and a kind of adaptive reflex to a shifting capitalist mode of production on the other. What's interesting about it, that tension, is that you can see it at the level of cultural reform too. So you read the articles in Aether, and sometimes they sound like utopian manifestos, they sound giddy and revolutionary, and they sound speculative. And other times, they sound deeply pragmatic. There's figures and tables and stuff like that, and this quality, sort of endless qualifiers and hedging. So the cultural form itself is caught between those two political positions of extreme radicalism and a kind of paternalistic, careful reformism. So alongside that utopian style, for instance, in the same article as the one I've just been talking about, there's a little advert in the corner that says, why don't we form a society linked to these ideals of degrowth, communalism, anarchism and everything? But very notably it says, this society will be suitable only for those who are prepared to attend and convene, if necessary, local weekly meetings. So you see there that kind of tension. Almost like a kind of hippie Rotary Club. You know, and what that is, as well, is a kind of residual work ethic of the middle classes, right? A puritanical work ethic. And it's one that reappears elsewhere in the countercultural press, though somewhat more disguised by Richard Neville's advocacy of play. Again and again, what seem like utopian visions of surpassing the division between work and leisure in the wake of automation can also be read differently as a middle-class fraction adapting itself to new kinds of work. So this is my second example, Bitman. Bitman grows out of International Times, and it's a sort of... it's almost like if the internet didn't exist, it would be necessary to invent it, right? And that's what Bitman is. It's a way of networking the counterculture, of bringing together its disparate expressions and circulating news of what's going on, and bringing people together. It grew out of the... International Times is one of the linchpins of the London countercultural press and the London countercultural scene. Not exclusively middle class by any means, but heavily dominated by the middle classes. So, for instance, Bitman was the brainchild of Cambridge University graduate John Hopkins. Its name was partly inspired by the phrase binary information transfer, and the original aim was to computerise the service in a foreshadowing of that kind of US countercultural involvement that you later get in the development of the internet in the 1980s and early 1990s. Lacking the technology and the means, though, in 1970, the first editorial of Bitman declares that it must be run by information freaks, people who treasure good information, love filing, and are prepared to work for free, at least for the time being. So despite the egalitarian elements of the project, it offered cheap food, a related phone line was free to call, volunteers would find crash pads, man, for people to stay. There were adverts in here for Peace News, for Trotskyist magazines, for the entire sort of fringe of the radical left. Despite all of that, there was a kind of reliance on unpaid labour sustained by enthusiasm and middle-class cultural capital. In a weird twist, even the kind of administrative, communicative white-collar work that automation promised eventually to minimise could be romanticised by the counterculture in a manner that they usually reserved, right, for artistic and artisan labour, whittling your own axe or whatever, going back to nature. But no, these guys were wanting to do that even with filing, right? And in class terms, this was a type of work that was not only exclusive in terms of those with the appropriate skills to do it, it was also exclusive and it was only open to those with the security and the confidence to work for no remuneration, at least for the time being. If we turn to what I call working class weirdos, and this is we see a somewhat different picture emerging. The concept of the working class weird is something that I've been working on recently. I've written in the past about the Manchester band The Fall, and I can't seem to leave them alone. There's something about The Fall that's endlessly productive of discourse. So given half the chance, which I was, I ended up writing another article on them recently, in which I kind of try and develop and elaborate the concept of a working class weird in more detail about what might constitute that. I don't have time to go into the details of that today, but it does kind of implicitly frame what I'm going to say about these sort of dissident, slightly class mobile, but slightly outsidery working class figures who are in some way connected to the counterculture. And if we look at those working class countercultural figures, we see a somewhat different attitude to the question of work and leisure emerging as the more middle class attitudes that we've seen in the past couple of examples in the underground press. So my first example is the broadcaster Ray Gosling, and the work that I look at by him, it long predates his kind of friendly, avuncular incarnation as a kind of linchpin of little documentaries about ordinary people's lives, which he would then go on to make from around about the mid to late 1970s onwards for the BBC and for ITV and so on. The text that I've chosen to focus on comes from 1961, so in a lot of ways it's kind of proto-countercultural, and the question of the linkage between that earlier kind of beatnik culture and the counterculture is one that I'm going to pursue in the project of this research. But he was astonishingly precocious, Olwer Goslin, in a brilliant way. So he writes his first memoir when he's 21, for instance. And to be fair to him, his life is interesting enough that he could kind of justify that in a way. You know, he comes from a working class background in Northampton. He goes to university in Leicester on a scholarship, hates it, absolutely hates it, is totally alienated by loads of aspects of that process, but class being a central one of them. I should mention that he's been to grammar school beforehand, so he perfectly fits the profile that I've been elaborating so far. And what he does when he drops out of university in Leicester is to form a rock and roll kind of proto-countercultural youth club in the late 50s, early 60s in Leicester, that's sponsored by none other than the New Left Review. He's lived a lot by the time he's 21. I think he's also given all that up and got a job as a railway signalman too, in another kind of echo of Raymond Williams there and Williams's dad in the background he comes from. And Goslin writes really beautifully and interestingly about work and pleasure in Sun Total. And he talks about this kind of brief experiment with a curious tactic in relation to work. And I think what he's doing when he writes about this is trying to negotiate that ambiguous social position that he finds himself in, neither one thing nor the other. Been to grammar school, dropped out of university and everything, deeply uncommon back then in the late 1950s, early 1960s, for someone of his background. And he doesn't really know what to do with himself, how to place himself socially, including in terms of the kind of job that he might do. So he finds himself down on his luck after the Revolutionary Youth Club's inevitable failure. And what he tries is this tactic that I've called nostalgia for graft. He goes and gets a production line job in a small leather goods factory, and he observes, "I think I earned my money. I suppose it's what they call a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. I'm content in my way." So you can see him almost kind of nostalgically trying to go back to perhaps the role that might have been allotted for him had he followed the usual conveyor belt path of someone from his class. It's a kind of residual class feeling that's just as residual and interesting in its way as those sort of middle class attachments to the service ethic that I was discussing earlier. And it's also just as romantic a gambit of dealing with the contradictions and challenges of a shifting mode of production. But the perspective afforded by his in-between class status makes Goslin much more self-conscious about the limitations of trying something as romantic of going back and working on a factory production line when you've already lived the kind of life that he has. That attempt at stability and authenticity, "I'm content in my way," he says. He doesn't stay content for long. That gets undermined by an acute awareness of the alienating effect of production line work, not just individually on his own mood, but systemically. So Goslin says this about the way eventually that it makes him feel to work in the factory. "You stop living and you go all hard dead. This has got nothing to do with the sensitive nature, the poor artist having to graft in a factory. It's the factory and the way they run it, and not in me, that the fault lies." That's not all that Goslin observes. He also notes, importantly, that this little leather goods factory is a declining industry. And so he recognises that new, presumably automated mass production of the kind of things that they're making in this little factory is going to render his tactic futile in the long run anyway. He's going to be put out of work. You get a similar dynamic playing out in the 1968 film Charlie Bubbles. You can see the great Albert Finney here, expressing in his face that classic sort of class misfit, who am I, what does this all mean, expression. So Charlie Bubbles was in large part the work of two Salfordian working class grammar school alumni. The playwright Sheila Delaney, better known of course for A Taste of Honey, who wrote the scripts to the film, and Albert Finney, of course, the star of many Angry Young Man filmic adaptations of 1950s plays. Finney's role in Charlie Bubbles was to both direct and star in the film. Finney's eponymous character, Charlie Bubbles, is a successful but dissolute writer who flees London in the film for his humble Mancunian roots in a vain attempt at social reconnection with a class background from which he comes. As Charlie lounges around a wonderfully du jour hotel suite in Piccadilly Plaza for any kind of fetishists of kind of post-war brutalist aesthetics, films work like me, the films worth watching just for aspects like that, to see how awfully they've clad Piccadilly Plaza now and ruined the entire concept of that square. But yeah, Piccadilly Plaza, believe it or not, in the 1960s was a kind of luxury hotel. It was a symbol of the kind of post-war, upwardly mobile glamour of Manchester. So that's where Charlie Bubbles, as this commercially successful writer, ends up when he comes back to Manchester. And what you get is this amazing scene in the film where Charlie gets served his breakfast by an old waiter who turns out to be a friend of his dad's, and they grew up together in the 1930s depression. So I'm going to show you a short clip of this because I think it's really interesting and there's almost too much to unpack in it, so I'll just focus on certain little elements. If you notice Liza Minnelli in the background, by the way, she's got this great supporting role as Charlie Bubbles' secretary who's having it away with whilst he's kind of exiled his own wife to an almost hippie life of back to nature on the land in the Peak District. Needless to say, she's not particularly happy about that. Okay, so like I say, yeah, 30-second clip there that I could go on about probably for a whole hour on its own. But there's certain things that are worth picking out there. For one, the actor Joe Gladwin's waiter character acts as a kind of switch point between two generations of the working class here. The seemingly more authentic world of depression and war and the expanding service industry of the post-war years. He occupies both. He's made that transition. Charlie Bubbles can't connect to either of those things, and nor can the waiter even conceive of Charlie's cultural production, his writing, his work. You just do your writing now, sir. You've got a job as well. The irony, though, is the potential accuracy of the waiter's apparent mistake, that in a still class-bound society, technological advance and the expansion of the cultural industries don't result in a kind of post-capitalist dream of merging work and leisure. Some, like the waiter, must continue grafting, while others, like Charlie, perform roles that appear leisured, though still leave them deeply alienated. And for those like Charlie Bubbles, this comes with the added twist of separating you irrevocably from the working class culture that formed you, which is in any case breaking up around you and changing. Albert Finney's acting here captures all the pathos and confusion of this situation. His first reaction to the waiter's misconception is a kind of supercilious smirk, if you watch carefully. And you see that suddenly fall as he realises the import of the statement. There's this kind of suddenly crestfallen glance upwards as he signs the bill. And I may be imagining this, but I'm sure that his final statement, no, I just do the writing, is delivered in a kind of exaggerated Lancashire lilt, in a doomed attempt at crossing that class divide and reconnecting with his roots. The waiter in Charlie Bubbles is not the only one to recognise the difficulties of surpassing the division between work and leisure within the boundaries and limits of late capitalist society. In Ray Gosling's Sum Total, Gosling articulates what sounds almost like a utopian socialist ideal of overcoming this alienated division of work and leisure. He says, "I wanted to lead the charmed life. I went from job to job searching, looking for some pattern, some way in which I could build up a life in the way I wanted, to work hard and fully, to make use of imagination, guts and a love of life, and yet not be tied down." Once free of his factory job, though, Gosling is also free of the structure that it imposed upon his life. He writes, "There becomes no leisure time. Work and home and out get fused. I just didn't know what to do with my time. I was only equipped for work and play. When the two came together, when the dream came true, I was lost." So, dislocated from that kind of almost Fordist structure of industrial labour and floating free, doing whatever little bits of work he can to survive. Like he says, work and home and out get fused. So at the very moment where he seems to be living a lifestyle where you can no longer clearly delineate between work and leisure, how he actually feels is confused, lost, more alienated than ever. Nevertheless, and what I think is one of the main wonderful things about Sum Total, he doesn't give up hope, despite the difficulty of collectively articulating a post-work future. Evoking the Western Marxist thinker Ernst Bloch in his identification of the fleeting utopian impulses present in mass culture, Ray Gosling reflects, "I still dream, we all dream, the pools, the horses, the book, the song. You stand at that bloody machine and hum and sing and dream and dream and dream. And you can never tell anyone what you really dream of. You daren't, for fear it would stop you coming to terms with the little compensation you have. Until after a time, you can't even put the dreams into words." Charlie Bubbles, meanwhile, joins the swinging London set, and his lifestyle seems to embrace a leisured future of technological optimism. Tellingly, his smart London home is equipped with a video monitoring system and PA in the office workplace. Yet the point of view shots from his writer's desk are preemptive of the surveilling, alienating qualities of new media technologies. So he's constantly spying on his servants the whole time. The fact that he's got people at his back on call isn't enough for it. There's a constant kind of breakdown of communication and frustration between them that's partly mediated by the fact that they very often don't communicate directly in the first instance. They communicate based on the fact that he's been spying on them through these early CCTV screens installed in his house. And importantly, Charlie's still resentfully dependent on very traditional human servants performing very traditional human labour, like cooking, for instance, in what is his usual state, which is a very drunken and petulant one. So Just like the earlier instance with the waiter, some people do the supposedly leisured work, other people still have to do the graft. As Zygmunt Bauman notes as well, in a rapidly technologising consumer society, we forget or fail to learn the skills of coping with life's challenges as more and more kind of commodities come onto the market offering to do it for us. It's no accident in this respect that Charlie slumped on a kind of high-tech sofa with a built-in phone and radio playing Muzak in that scene that I've just showed you. So he's surrounded by this supposedly automated technology that does everything for you, and yet he's still deeply alienated nevertheless. I mentioned earlier on in the lecture that you can see a lot of these tensions expressed at the level of cultural form. And I briefly went into that with the example of ether, that you get that strange juxtaposition of utopianism and pragmatism and hedging kind of butting up against each other in the tone of the articles. And you see that those kind of contortions and developments of cultural form too in the work of working class weirdos like Albert Finney, Sheila Delaney, Ray Gosling. These texts deal with the kind of outsider class status in really interesting formal ways. How do they do that? Well, as the cultural materialist critic Alan Sinfield has noted, subcultural meaning, like all meaning, works through a strategic reordering of what is to hand. Subordinate cultures are tangled up with the oppression they're trying to handle. These are the conditions in which people try and negotiate cultural space. Therefore, what we see in both Subtotal and Charlie Bubbles is a kind of appropriation of middle-class countercultural tropes by socially mobile working class figures on the one hand, and what they do with those on the other hand is amalgamate those kind of countercultural forms with ones that we might more traditionally associate with the working class. So in Sum Total, for instance, there are clear influences from the beat movement, the rhythmic, spontaneous stream of consciousness qualities to the prose, which contribute to its visionary air. Interestingly, though, these are contained within the genre of autobiography. As Raymond Williams has argued, this has been attractive historically to those from working class backgrounds who've been shaped by a Christian culture of testimony and confession. So autobiography, right, seems to make sense as a cultural form for you to adopt from a working class background. Indeed, confession is one of the sutures between those two forms, the beat on the one hand and the autobiography on the other, lending Sum Total a sincerity that's often lacking in more irreverent manifestations of the counterculture. The other kind of suitor between the two forms is captured in Raymond Williams' description of class-conscious autobiography. What Williams argues about working-class autobiographies is that they're at once the representative and the exceptional account of somebody from that class background. As with the beat outsider, a story is offered that aims to critically map the social, whilst both difficulties and the fragile possibilities of doing so are captured by the marginal, ambiguous, or exceptional perspective. So in the case of the beat, that kind of bohemianism, in the case of the working class weirdo, their dislocation, both from traditional working class culture on the one hand and middle class culture on the other. There's a quasi-autobiographical feel to Charlie Bubbles too, with the character's trajectory partially mirroring those of Finney and Delaney. In its settings and concerns, there are residual elements as well of the social realism that had facilitated working class representation since the 1950s. But what I love about this, and what you also see in Sheila Delaney's film the short film The White Bus, which is really worth seeking out if you haven't seen it, is this kind of surrealist bus tour around Salford. What you get is a kind of fusion of grainy, gritty, black and white social realism with much more kind of irreverent, surrealistic countercultural aesthetics. And in particular, what you get in Charlie Bubbles is that kind of countercultural theme of the daydream as escape. So Mark Fisher, for instance, detects in songs like The Beatles, I'm Only Sleeping, and The Small Faces, Lazy Sunday, songs that map out worlds beyond work through the kind of rubric of the daydream. At the conclusion of the film, faced with his compounded dilemmas, seemingly no way out of them, Charlie steps onto an enormous, lysurgically orange hot air balloon and drifts away over the Peak District. So, I'll wrap up then. And I'll do so by returning to that question I posed initially. Can the legacy of the counterculture still play a role in contemporary left imaginaries of a post-work society? Or, given the kind of tensions and differences that you see existing between middle-class counterculture and working-class counterculture, is it actually just more likely to set people against each other? In some respects, it doesn't bode well. If we think of the kind of contemporary liberal commentariat explanation for Brexit, again and again we hear that people voted for it because they weren't educated, which when you dig deeper ideologically, is often a kind of metonym for the perception that these uneducated people don't share in a contemporary urban lifestyle that owes much to one strand of the counterculture in its embrace of the cultural industries, innovation alongside romantic preservation, cosmopolitanism, and that commodified blurring of high and popular culture. That old civilising service ethic, which sometimes means well but remains incorrigibly elitist, strikes again in today's middle-class liberal kind of diagnosis of why it is that the working class voted for Brexit. Today's advocates of a crumpled status quo, the centrist dads, as I referred to them earlier, in a keyword meeting, often come from a class fraction living out the incorporated neoliberal dream of a work-leisure collapse. Occupying what the journalist Joel Golby has called globalised airspace, after a kind of map air range demonstrated here. They work from MacBooks in identikit hipster cafes or tasteful Airbnbs, whose aesthetics are determined not by individual quirky taste, but unbelievably by automated algorithms. I discovered this recently, right, that when somebody wants to sort of do a startup now for a hipster cafe or a kind of new media digital office or a trendy Airbnb in a city like Amsterdam or Berlin or New York or whatever, there are now algorithms that will program how an individualistic, quirky, off-the-wall space will look. And this class faction seem blind to the fact that others must graft to facilitate that lifestyle. Not only this, but also that as automation comes for service sector working class labour, and austerity destroys what's left of the welfare state, there will inevitably be fear, anger and frustration about the future. Such effect will only be fanned towards the rising right by those who patronise it. And we see this right in the way that the new evolving right have been so successful in directing a certain fraction of the working class frustrations towards a supposed urban, liberal, cosmopolitan elite. That owes much to the counterculture, I would argue, in its general sensibility. It's not all negative, however. I'm going to end on a hopeful note, as I usually do. The continual expansion of education has materially produced a class fraction that in a lot of ways is kind of comparable to that post-war period of social mobility, though we might know that all the extra working class people going to university today have much less chance of eventual prosperity than the generation before them did. But perhaps it's amongst this constituency especially, today's class mobile working class weirdos, that the appropriative aesthetics and the tentative utopianism of texts like Sum Total and Charlie Bubbles might strike a chord. Importantly, these attempts to perceive anew don't always end at the escapism of Charlie getting on his orange hot air balloon and disappearing away. Sometimes they indicate the possibility of a transformative alliance of class fractions in the service of something better. Visiting a coal mine in a foreshadowing of a broadcasting career that gave voice to those often denied it, Ray Gosling writes, "It's much easier for the man who had no struggle, There are no inhibitions, no jealousies, no rivalry. You know where he stands, apart. But you see, I don't feel I do. I'm like a refugee. This is something rather new. We're not sure, any of us. But I must stay until there's been a give and take, a communication. You see, out of necessity, we must get together.